l'Italia ha scelto noi.
Italy has chosen us. It's important to understand that if we are called to govern this nation, we will do it for all Italians, with a clear objective of uniting the people. Because the great objective that we've always had as a political force is that of ensuring Italians may once again be proud to be Italians.
Italian politician Giorgia Meloni speaking at a campaign event yesterday. She is likely to become Italy's next prime minister, the first woman to hold the job. Her far-right coalition won the most votes yesterday. She has long been an admirer of fascist dictator Benito Mussolini. Her party, the Brothers of Italy, has a platform that is anti-immigration, anti-European Union, and anti-abortion. And she is publicly anti-LGBTQ, has also suggested revisiting the country's same-sex civil union law. Ruth Ben-Ghiat joins me now to talk about her and the growing appeal of fascism in Italy. She's a professor of history and Italian studies at New York University and author of the book Strong Men, Mussolini to the Present. Welcome back to Press Play, Ruth.
Thank you.
Well, tell us more about Giorgia Meloni. She has been in Italian politics for quite some time, but she's fairly young. What has she promised Italy?
So she is calling herself a conservative. But she comes from a past of a hardcore neo-fascist militancy. And she was the head of the, in the 90s, the head of the youth organization. And that was when there's a video going around where she said Mussolini was a great politician. And she has been responsible for carrying forth the spirit of fascism into the party. In fact, the party logo has a flame in it, and she's insisted that that flame stay there, and that was the logo of the original neo-fascist party. So how does that work out? It works out with, as you said, opposition to same-sex unions, conspiracy theories, what we call great replacement theory. She's many times espoused that. But even more extreme, she believes there's a design, a plan by Soros and the EU to have mass immigration that's going to kind of extinguish white identity. So she's really rather a conspiracy theorist as well.
How much of this is overtly or subtly anti-Semitic?
That's an interesting question because she is very careful to say that fascism is a thing of the past, along with the racial laws, which is what, you know, other normalizing far-right politicians have said too. But who knows? Because as we well know, she's very anti-Islam and very pro-Christian, and she doesn't mention Judeo-Christian, just mentions Christian identity. And so when, as we know from Eastern Europe and other places, and Orban, and when you're talking about Soros, she's obsessed with George Soros, that is an environment that can lead to a spike in anti-Semitic crimes.
Right. So George Soros is often invoked by these people as code, I suppose.
Yes, and she repeatedly talks about him as an international speculator, and again, she actually thinks that he's the mastermind of immigration. He's like a kind of, you know, as he is for Orban, trying to wreck European identity and Italian identity. So she's a very extreme figure, and yet you're going to hear her many times now talking about how she's a conservative.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so this idea that these were just the passions of youth, that she's now mellowed with age, that's not accurate.
I don't think it's accurate. And look who she chose for her governing partners, the League of Salvini. And he called for, you know, mass cleansings of immigrants. And then the other partner is Berlusconi, who's a convicted criminal and one of the most pro-Putin figures in Europe around. He just released a video a few days ago, you know, saying, like, defending Putin's occupation, you know, into Ukraine, which not that many people are doing right now. So she's got some pretty extreme partners herself.
Although she has indicated her support for Ukraine, right?
She has, but she was very pro-Putin until it was inconvenient to be so. Mm-hmm. And in fact, in 2018, 2019, she's always congratulating Putin publicly if he wins a re-election, saying it's the will of the Russian people speaking. So she's got, if you think about the most extreme Republican, she's very close to Steve Bannon. That's important to know. She's been to the National Prayer Breakfast. She's been to CPAC, and I'm sure we're going to see more of her, just like we've seen more of Orban. And there's this kind of transnational far-right network that she talks about, and she's mentioned the GOP several times as being fighting the same battles as she's fighting.
Oh, fascinating. What about the European Union? Is Italy's presence in it, membership in it, after all, it was a founding nation, now in jeopardy?
I don't think so, because it's just Italy's way too central. And also, you know, Italy has a very high unemployment rate right now. Its economy is not doing well, and that will be a constraint on her. Well, and it's very important to see who she picks as a finance minister. But the EU also has gotten, finally, a little more tough with the example of Orban. It recently made a rule of law conditionality clause saying that if you don't observe the rule of law, if you are no longer a democracy, which it says to Hungary, then your funds can be severely reduced or frozen. Mm. So they're coming into this experience with a far more central and important nation than Hungary, which is Italy, armed with some democratic protection weapons that it could use.
So, right. So Italy would need that money and that support from the EU. Speaking of Italian governments, they don't last very long, perhaps because of the financial upheaval in Italy. It's been not doing well for many, many years economically. How long can her government expect to hang on, given that most Italian governments last less than 2 years?
Yeah, she could be out in a year or two, and, you know, the governing it depends who she has a very clear majority in parliament, and her party did far better than the parties of her partners, let's say the League and Forza Italia of Berlusconi. But it will all depend on how much she's able to, become a moderate, even if it's just a window dressing. Mm-hmm. And actually work with people. It depends who she picks for the cabinet. If she picks centrists or technocrats, as they're called in Italy, for important, finance minister, et cetera, maybe she could last a little bit longer. But as you say, it's notoriously easy to sink a government in Italy. You know, coalition partners can pull out. Mm-hmm. So that remains to be seen.
Well, broadly, what does this say about Italy and Italians embracing a neo-fascist? And Germany has so far not done that, yet both were led by fascist dictators, anti-Semitic fascist dictators in World War II.
Yeah, and it's really good comparison to draw because Italy, the Allies gave Italy a bit of a pass. Mm-hmm. Italy did not, partly because of the Cold War, and Italy had a huge, the biggest communist party in Western Europe. So the Allies did not subject Italy to the kind of equivalent of denazification, and had the attitude that Italians were good people who fell under the spell of a bad man. And so that meant that fascism had a different history, and in fact, the party that formed Meloni, the neo-fascist party, was formed in 1946, and it was the fourth largest party by the 1960s in Italy, which is inconceivable in Germany. And there's huge amounts of fascist architecture, fascist art. It's just part of their heritage in a way that is not possible in Germany because of the Allies and because of law, the legal structure that mm-hmm. was put in place.
Ruth Ben-Ghiat, author of the book Strong Man, Mussolini to the Present. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Sure, it's a pleasure.
Here in the United States, more states are restricting access to abortion after the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade this summer. And abortion laws are becoming clearer in states with pre-Roe bans on the books that hadn't been enforced since the early 70s, like Arizona, where a judge ruled on Friday that the state's Civil War era ban on abortions, yes, Civil War era, could now be enforced. It's Monday, so Press Play's Legal Eagle is here. Loyola Law School professor Jessica Levinson, hi.
who ever thought we would say Civil War era ban and
just
have a
mind-boggling.
Legal
I know. 1864, this law was passed. So, but this is before Arizona was even a state. So what does this say about abortion, this law?
Well, and before women had the right to vote, of course, about 50 years before, or excuse me, more than that. So what it says is we're going to ban all abortions except in the case of the life of the pregnant person. And I believe that the law was basically updated and codified in 1901. What happens is, of course, the law is put on hold because in 1973, the Supreme Court says there's a constitutional right to obtain an abortion, and they lay out that trimester framework. Mm-hmm. So the law was only put on hold because of that 1973 decision in Roe. Now, despite that, it looks like Arizona actually tried to reenact the law in 1977, which I think was merely symbolic because they knew that Roe v. Wade at the time was the law of the land. There was federal constitutional protection. And what we now know from talking about the Dobbs decision for so long is that the federal constitution, of course, trumps states, and states could not completely ban abortion until about 2 months ago.
Right. So Arizona Governor Doug Ducey signed a 15-week abortion ban that was supposed to take effect over the weekend. And that only allows for abortions in a medical emergency. Restrictive, but not as restrictive as this one we're talking about. So he said that this law would supersede the 19th century law, but the attorney general in Arizona, Mark Brnovich, said no, the older one should take precedence. How did the judge respond to that argument?
Well, he agreed. He said, okay, I'm looking at the law. I'm looking at why it was no longer in effect. And that's the Roe decision. Roe was overturned. And that means that the Arizona law, this 1864 and then 1901 law that completely bans abortion, except in cases of the life of the pregnant person, that now basically springs back to life. It's a weird kind of iteration of the trigger laws. Now, the 15-week law was, of course, passed in March with the anticipation, as many red states had, that the court was about to overturn Roe v. Wade, which it did. And the governor, I believe, argued that the law that he signed takes precedence, but out of court. I think he wanted to see it play out in court, frankly, the way it did. And it's another example of the fact that the Dobbs decision, far from, as the court, in my view, said, well, this will settle it, it actually caused a lot of legal chaos.
So where are we now on Monday? If you're in Arizona, which law applies to you if you are a pregnant person?
So right now, the law that applies, I believe, is the 1864-1901 law that bans abortion, again, except in the case of the life of the pregnant person. And it's important, I think, to remember that there was so much chaos leading up to this decision that my understanding is that abortion was basically shut down in the state prior to this, prior to our discussion today, and that a lot of women were traveling to neighboring states. There's only one Planned Parenthood office in Arizona in Tucson, and they said that the moment the decision came out, they had to stop turning people, they had to start turning people away. And I think that was one of the few places where women could legally obtain abortions in Arizona. The question, legally speaking, will be, will there be an appeal, or will the legislature decide to try and pass a new law saying very specifically what their intent is?
And who would appeal it? Planned Parenthood?
So, right, exactly. It could be Planned Parenthood that could appeal. You could see, I don't think this would happen, and some of this depends on which would be the proper parties, but you could see the governor, if he really wanted to say, my law takes precedent, I believe that he could actually appeal. But again, I don't think he will, because politically speaking, he's happy with this outcome.
Okay. So meanwhile, the Department of Justice has formed a task force that's keeping an eye on state laws like this one, and basically to make sure that federal laws aren't being violated and to advise federal agencies how to navigate all this. And last week, the DOJ said it would defend employees at the VA if they're sued or prosecuted for their role in helping patients obtain an abortion. So that would be kind of just looking at the federal agency. The VA is federal. What is their argument?
And this is really the last place where the Department of Justice does have power, is making sure that federal law, where it is in conflict with state law or state action, prevails. And there is a federal law that says that if you have to provide emergency treatment and stabilize patients, and in this case, if employees from the Veterans Administration need to provide certain care, that federal law should trump, that they should be able to provide that care, and that any state that tries to prosecute them or in any way go after them for providing them with that care could not do so, that the Department of Justice basically will have their back. And this is part of what the Department of Justice's entire strategy is, which is to try and strengthen executive orders, to try and implement existing federal laws, and to explain to states, you have an enormous amount of power to do what you want in your own jurisdiction. But when it comes to, for instance, the VA or hospitals that accept Medicare funding, then we have a role to play.
So if there's a VA campus in Arizona, for example, women could go there, presumably, to obtain an abortion?
So I will emphasize the word presumably. I think we're going to see these types of fights play out. But yes, I would say that the better legal answer is that VA employees who are acting according to federal law, even in a state that would say, no, you can't do that, that because those two laws would be in conflict, that the federal law, the federal policy should be able to trump.
And then they're also suing states like Idaho over its almost complete abortion ban. What's going on there, briefly?
Right, exactly. So what they're doing is basically saying that there's a federal law, the Emergency Medical Treatment Labor Act, and it would require hospitals that, as we talked about before, get some federal funding. Mm-hmm. In this case, the federal funding is Medicare, and that's what allows the federal government to have some power, that you need to allow medical workers to, in fact, provide that emergency medical treatment. And so if that includes providing an abortion, they do not want the state of Idaho to go after these medical providers.
Because they're using federal funds to do that. That's an interesting argument.
Exactly.
Jessica Levinson, Loyola Law School professor and Press Play's regular legal eagle. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, California is poised to build offshore wind farms for the first time, but some environmentalists are not happy about that. We'll have that story next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. California could soon see its first offshore wind projects. The Biden administration chose two sections off the California coast to build massive wind turbines, which could help the state become carbon neutral, its goal, by 2045. But California's coastal waters are vital to industries like shipping, fishing, even telecommunications. They're also vital to the health of the planet because they sustain delicate marine ecosystems. And these other interests could potentially derail this project. That's according to Katie Stech-Farrick. She's a reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so is this a done deal, these turbines, or do other things need to happen before they're built?
Oh, well, there's plenty of steps that have to happen before they're built. I mean, there is a sense that these projects are coming offshore and that there's interest in building them. But right now, the Interior Department is weighing all those interests that you mentioned in the intro. And there are so many eyes on this region. It's so valuable to so many different groups and industries. That's what they're wading through right now.
All right. And so what is their plan? If they do go ahead with it, where would these turbines be built?
One's a little north of Santa Barbara near Morro Bay. One is off Humboldt County, just south of the Oregon border, a little more remote than the southern site. These were sites that have been designated for as big regions where turbines could take place. And the Interior Department is trying to figure out exactly what the borders are going to be, where they're going to be located, and what will be up for sale later this year.
And how many of them would there be, these turbines? What would it look like?
You know, I don't think we know that information just yet. Yeah. They'll be really far. What will they look like? They'll be really far offshore. I mean, I think there's a sense from everybody that they'll be really hard to see. So not as much of an eyesore issue as we've seen with other projects along the East Coast. It'll be a really interesting project for these developers because the shelf drops off so quickly off the West Coast. These are going to have to be built on floating platforms, which, I mean, it's been done in Europe, but this is the first time we'll see this technology in the U.S. So it's going to be a really big engineering feat. And there's a lot of excitement, you know, among the community to build these, to be the first to build this type of technology. But also a lot of questions about how it's going to work, how the cables are going to go, that kind of stuff.
But what are the more substantive objections then?
So we heard a lot from commercial fishing groups. I mean, there's going to be sections where you can't tow a net anymore. It won't be safe. And so that industry is really concerned about the loss of access to some really rich fishing grounds. We heard from environmental groups because we aren't quite sure how marine and avian life will interact with some of these turbines. There's a concern that if debris gets caught in some of the cables anchoring these platforms to the seabed, wildlife get stuck. There's also concerns about birds and whether they would run into the turbines. You know, probably a bigger concern for that community because a bird strike like that could be fatal and far more deadly than maybe a concerned mammal swimming up to see what's caught in the cables. So there's some concerns there that were raised.
Mm. Right. And we've seen that problem with land-based wind turbines, that the birds can get caught in them.
Yeah, it's almost a little different for offshore, though, because at least with land turbines, we have some groups that are comfortable, you know, counting the number of deaths, and there's some monitoring technology. And we don't have that with offshore platforms. You know, if a bird makes contact with a turbine and dies, you don't have a carcass that you can go out and study the scope of the problem if there is a major problem.
And there are 5 national marine sanctuaries off the California coast.
Right, and another one on the way. The Commerce Department is in the process of designating a very large section very close to the Morro Bay region. And developers are concerned that with that designation coming, you know, can you put a transmission cable through the marine sanctuary? How would it work? Will it block their path? I mean, it'd be a really large space to go around. So that's been raised among some of the developers as a concern for Interior to try to work through as they figure out exactly where these leasing areas are going to be.
How would it look? I'm envisioning a pipe snaking along the floor, the ocean floor. Is that not what it is? What does it look like when it's actually in the water?
Exactly. The floating platforms are going to have to be anchored to the floor. And then on top of that, you'll have these transmission lines to bring the electricity generated onshore. So then that's where you talk about port infrastructure as well, because once it gets near shore, like where do you put the transmission lines that are needed, and how do they cross on into land, and how do you hook it up to the grid? There's a lot of infrastructure that's going to have to be built, which is why residents and tribes in these two regions are really watching this closely to make sure how the land portion of the infrastructure that's going to be built will affect them.
Right. Well, it seems like there are always trade-offs when it comes to these big power projects, right? There's always somebody who's going to have to suffer for the greater good of having clean energy, right? So I guess, how are these varying concerns balanced? Is it even possible?
That's why I'm so fascinated by these projects. We have all these groups that are concerned. They want to protect their interests, and they also recognize that clean power is something that they want. We've seen environmental groups be very supportive of these projects in the last couple of years. And so they're trying to engage. As I was reporting the story, I could just tell that there were a lot of organizations that want these to be built because they understand the role of a cleaner energy source and how important that is. At the same time, they're nervous about how that will affect their interests. I think everybody is taking that nervous anxiety and just trying to engage and hoping that Interior will work through their concerns, try to make it so that the impact could be a little less for each group and what their interests are. But you're right, there's no such thing as building these in a way that won't affect some groups and their industries and their livelihood. And that nervous energy is out there for sure.
Katie Stetch-Farrick, she's a reporter for The Wall Street Journal, where she covers Congress, climate, and the environment. Katie, thank you.
Thanks so much for having me.
Coming up, the scandal involving NFL star Brett Favre. Millions of dollars meant for Mississippi's poorest residents went to him and his pet projects instead.
While he says he doesn't know that the money was supposed to serve poor people, he did know that it was coming from the state's social safety net agency, and that's the agency that is tasked with helping people in poverty in Mississippi.
That story is next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Earlier this year, the state of Mississippi sued NFL Hall of Fame quarterback Brett Favre for misspending millions of dollars in state welfare funds. He's one of nearly 40 people, along with the state's former governor, Phil Bryant, who are implicated in Mississippi's largest public corruption case. Favre allegedly used state welfare dollars to help build a volleyball stadium at his alma mater, the University of Southern Mississippi. His daughter was on the school's volleyball team at the time. Well, now newly released text messages between Favre and the former governor show Favre repeatedly pushed for the funding. And a few years later, he tried to do it again to get money for the school's football team, even though he had been warned that that could be illegal. Joining us to talk about all this is Anna Wolf, investigative reporter for the digital news nonprofit Mississippi Today. She broke this story. Welcome to Press Play, Anna.
Thank you so much for having me.
Great to have you. I know you've been on this story for a long time now. There are, 38 people and organizations named in a civil suit. This happened back in May. What are the allegations?
So this is an attempt on the part of the state to claw back money that was misspent from a federal fund called Temporary Assistance for Needy Families. You know, there were also six people who were arrested on criminal charges related to this misspending. The total amount that auditors are saying was misspent was at least $77 million. The allegations of theft are a smaller portion of that, but the civil suit attempts to recoup around $25 million from these 38 people, including Brett Favre, as you mentioned, and the former welfare director and nonprofit heads that were spending the money.
And Favre has not been criminally charged, right?
That's correct. There is an ongoing FBI investigation. John Davis is the former head of DHS that Brett Favre was at times communicating with about the projects that he was getting funded by the department. And he pled guilty last week and agreed to aid the prosecution in its ongoing investigation. So I think we're going to see the ball rolling on, you know, people flipping and turning over information that prosecutors find valuable.
Wow. Also included is a woman who ran the nonprofit, which funneled, these are federal welfare dollars, TANF funds, funneled some of this $77 million. And she was in contact with Brett Favre, right? And funneled the money to his projects, which was a total of how much money?
So Brett Favre sort of inspired the spending of over $8 million in federal welfare funds. There was the volleyball project that he lobbied the welfare department to spend $5 million to build a volleyball stadium. There was an additional $1.1 million payment that went directly to Favre. He was supposed to be promoting this anti-poverty program, but text messages reveal that that was really just a way to get more money to the volleyball stadium. And then there was an additional $2 million in stolen welfare money that was put into personal investments in a pharmaceutical startup company that Brett was investing in and trying to get state support for.
Okay, so this is a total of $8 million that he received,
yes,
which is a lot. Did he say he didn't know this money came from this federal welfare fund?
That's right. He certainly did know that the money was coming from the Department of Human Services because he was working with the director and even in communication with for example, his business associate, he said that Nancy New was giving him $5 million for the volleyball facility via grant funds, and at one point said that he believed that they were using federal funds for the pharmaceutical investment. While he says he doesn't know that the money was supposed to serve poor people, he did know that it was coming from the state's social safety net, and that's the agency that is tasked with helping people in poverty in Mississippi.
Right. And so, as you say, the head of that has pleaded guilty. And this woman, Nancy New, she was friends with the governor's wife. So what is the governor's alleged involvement in all this? The former governor.
Mm-hmm. Former Governor Phil Bryant was in charge of the welfare agency. The Department of Human Services is an agency under the governor's office. So essentially, John Davis, the former agency head, was an employee of Phil Bryant's. And Phil Bryant had the power to direct John Davis on how to spend money. Just this morning, we published a story that contained a new allegation from another individual who was receiving welfare money named Ted DiBiase Jr. He's a former WWE wrestler. He alleged that Phil Bryant directed John Davis to actually cut funding to one of the nonprofits that was receiving welfare grants because that nonprofit's director supported the Democratic candidate for governor that year. There were different influences that were being levied on this welfare agency to spend the money that was politically advantageous to our state's politically elected leaders.
And what is former Governor Bryant's response to all this? What does he say?
So he denies that he knew that the money that Nancy New was putting into the volleyball stadium was welfare money. He says the same thing with regards to the pharmaceutical company, even though Brett Favre offered Governor Bryant stock in that company in exchange for his help as governor and notified him that they were receiving money from the state of Mississippi by text message that I obtained, and then agreed 2 days after leaving office to accept that stock in that company. But he says that he didn't read his text messages carefully enough to appreciate what they meant.
Hmm. Well, speaking of text messages, there's one that is seemingly pretty damning when it comes to Brett Favre, where he is quoted in one text as saying, "Is there any way the media could find out where it came from?" Meaning the money for the volleyball stadium and how much. And he's texting Nancy New.
Right. And that was the whole scheme, was that this welfare money that was supposed to be spent, you know, within public view and with accountability measures in place, it was all being funneled through these private nonprofits who then had free rein to spend the money essentially how they wanted, and then didn't even report back to the state agency how they were spending the money. So someone like me, who was actually looking into the agency and this particular program before all of this broke, was unable to obtain any information that showed how they were spending the money. It essentially became a black hole. And I want to make the point, too, that this federal program has such lax rules around spending, and we don't know how this money is being spent across the country. Mississippi could be not unique in this, and we wouldn't really know unless there was someone checking up like the auditor here did and reporters who have been on top of it.
Right. So this is the 1996 welfare to work law that former President Clinton championed. And this replaced direct cash payments to the poor with block grants to the states. So, as you say,
exactly,
enabling this kind of thing to happen, kind of a big black hole for the money to go in. And that's up to state officials to decide where it goes. Meanwhile, Mississippi has the nation's highest poverty rate, right?
Right. And so people have been kind of stunned, like, why didn't this money go to the intended program, you know, welfare? They think of the welfare check as the intended program. That population that has been receiving the cash welfare check has dwindled dramatically since the 90s, because when they reformed welfare, that meant not only that states were given all this flexibility to spend the money the ways they wanted, but it made it so that the welfare check was not an entitlement anymore. It's not an entitlement like food assistance or Medicaid. So states can really deny access to it at their discretion. The state during this scandal was denying up to 99% of people who were applying for this assistance.
Wow. And giving it allegedly to all of these rich people instead.
That's right.
Well, I want to thank you so much for your reporting. No one would know this was happening were it not for your work on this. So thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
Anna Wolf, investigative reporter for Mississippi Today. Coming up, how Bad Bunny is using his mega stardom to try to help the poor in Puerto Rico. And we'll listen to some of his music from his latest album. Don't miss it. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. That's El Apagón by the reggaeton sensation Bad Bunny. He's just put out the music video for this song. It translates to the blackout in English. And at 22 minutes long, the video is more like a mini documentary telling the story of his fellow Puerto Ricans and their ability to persevere despite the fact that they are dealing with chronic power outages 5 years after Hurricane Maria really devastated that island. Much of Puerto Rico is without power again after Hurricane Fiona swept the Caribbean earlier this month. But El Apagón is also a celebration of Puerto Rico, and Bad Bunny is the island's certified superstar, the only artist to have an all-Spanish language album top the American charts. His latest, Un Verano Sin Ti, came out back in May, and it is still the number one album in the United States, and he is selling out stadiums across North America. He'll be performing two nights at SoFi this weekend. We're going to talk about his influence now with two guests. Maria Elena Cepeda is professor of Latino and Latina Studies at Williams College. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
And Izzy Ramirez, editor at Vox, where she recently wrote about Bad Bunny. Welcome to you.
Hi, all.
All right. It's great to have you both. Maria Elena, let's begin with you. Tell us first what you think of this long music video slash documentary and what Bad Bunny's trying to say there.
I think it's really significant on several fronts. First, here we have Bad Bunny. He's not just producing culture, right? Music, as he normally does, but he's also producing journalistic content along with Bianca Kralau, the independent journalist who's featured in the small documentary slash music video. I think that's significant. In many ways, we're seeing Bad Bunny doing the work of the state.
Interesting. Izzy, tell us more about what's in this video and what he's talking about.
Yeah, sure. So in the music video, you know, it starts off with, you know, the music, some dancing, some, you know, shots of the island. And then right when you think like the beat's going to drop, you see some infrastructure collapse. Then it goes to Bianca's reporting, right, about, you know, how since the privatization of the electricity grid by Luma, a Canadian-American company, you know, there have been more blackouts. And that's also on top of gentrification that the island is facing post-Maria with some tax break laws that allow for non-Puerto Ricans to, you know, not have to pay income taxes in exchange for, you know, helping the island, quote unquote, recover financially. Now, whether or not that actually happens is kind of up for debate. Because there have been, you know, impacts with the beaches being public and whatnot. And the song lyrically also gets at that, too. So the reporting is all kind of contextualizing the song.
Maria Elena, was Bad Bunny always political?
I don't think quite so overtly political. I think his image and our understanding of him has shifted over time. What is interesting to me is the way in which now, if you do a simple Google search of Bad Bunny, you know, I did that kind of to get a sense of, all right, what's the snapshot of him that exists out there in the world, particularly for people that are outside of the Puerto Rican or outside of the Latinx community. And he's getting framed very much as somebody who is the star that gets credited with mainstream in Spanish language music. Mm-hmm. I guess I want to push back against the idea of mainstream, because in Latin music, the idea of mainstream, of crossover, of breaking through is something that really dominates the history of Latin music and our understanding of it in the United States. But I would say that that idea of mainstream has shifted over time, and we really need to recognize that. So I question sort of the logic of saying that he's the first, or that mm-hmm. even that Spanish language music isn't mainstream already.
Right. And so his identification, strong identification with Puerto Rico, and that he's singing only in Spanish or mainly in Spanish, but yet has this huge following in North America, though, that that is huge, right? And in a way, that is mainstreaming for people who may don't even speak Spanish. They listen to Bad Bunny.
Yeah, and that is quite an achievement, and that's very significant. But I just want to say that, you know, if this is the fourth largest Spanish-speaking country in the world, and Puerto Rico is so closely tied to the United States, why do we persist in saying this is music, and this is a language, and these are cultures that are sort of outside of the United States exclusively, right? It's sort of reifying this boundary between who's foreign and who's local. Right? Who's American and who's not real American, when Puerto Ricans and Latinxes are, you know, Americans, just like English-speaking Americans, right?
Yeah, of course. So, Izzy, talk a little bit more about what happened over the summer when he played these concerts for Puerto Ricans. And it was kind of a phenomenon. Can you describe what happened?
Yeah, sure. I mean, Un Verano Sin Ti is the album of the summer, and these concerts really reflect that. He started his tour with, like, probably the most, like, incredible show I've seen from him yet. And it was, like, I think it was, like, 3 to 4 nights of just, like, insanity, like, 4 hours long, like, bringing out artists after artists that have been, like, so important to, you know, the musical canon, who are, like, not only featured on the album, but just have, like, their own, like, incredible works that a lot of Puerto Ricans really, you know, vibe with. And like this show, like mind you, was broadcasted on local television. That's like if Beyonce, you know, took over ABC for 4 hours to play Renaissance, right? Like that's kind of like the same level of, I guess, like cultural momentness, of cultural power. There were like streaming parties all over the island. You know, it was like you had to be there. And like the fact that, you know, not only is he talking about like these political moments with El Apagón, but, you know, just like making sure that like these shows were for Puerto Ricans, like the way that they were advertised, the way that the tickets were sold, all of it was to ensure that it was Puerto Ricans who benefited from this, you know, show that was like a love letter to the island and to its people.
Well, let's hear some more music then, because you have whetted our appetite. And this is a song. This is actually from 2019, and it's called Afilando los Cuchillos, which translates to sharpening the knives. Hay que arrancar la maleza del plantío pa que ninguno se aproveche de lo mío. El pueblo no aguanta más injusticia. Se cansó de tus mentiras y de que manipulen las noticias. Ey, ey, todos los combos, los caseríos, somos nuestra milicia. Ya no nos coges de p. Eres un corrupto que de corrupto coges consejo. Arranca p. Vete lejos y denle la bienvenida a la generación de yo no me dejo. Y quizás tú en tu grupo como yo en el mío. Okay, so that's Bad Bunny performing with some other artists from Puerto Rico, Residente and Ila. And in this verse, he says the Puerto Rican people can't stand the injustices. And he really criticizes the former governor of Puerto Rico, Maria Elena. How does he interact with official Puerto Rico, the government, the officials, the powers that be?
He addresses them very directly. I think he is very good, like Residente and Ila R, at sort of harnessing the power of culture for political purposes. And it's not just a politics that's directed at the government or the governor of Puerto Rico, the president of the United States, you know, political figures. It's also very much a politics of the everyday. For example, of gender and sexuality, he's constantly reminding us of Puerto Rico, the land and its people. One of the things I love, just, you know, kind of think back to the video that he released just this week, you know, El Apagón, is he sort of uses the video to remind us that Puerto Ricans are on that land. The island is, this isn't this empty space where there are no consequences for our actions, right? Aquí vive gente, he says. People live here. And so it's this constant reminder. And I just love the way that he's employing music and sound as political forces.
But is he seen by the government as dangerous in the sense that he is really talking about these political issues that perhaps could rile up the population against what's happening? Yeah.
He's filling in a political vacuum. Absolutely. And I think the government would be very wise to be attentive to the power that he possesses.
Well, he's not just political. He's also has a, a soulful side to him. He makes a lot of sexy love songs. So let's hear an example of that. This one's called Agosto. It means August. Let's talk about his sex appeal and what he is telegraphing. I also want to note that he is pretty vocal about transgender rights. And I think, you know, when he performed at the MTV Video Music Awards, he kissed a woman backup dancer on the lips, and then he turned to a male dancer and also kissed him on the lips. So tell us more about that side of Bad Bunny.
Okay, so, like, I think the thing to note here is, like, very much like in the U.S. and Puerto Rico and other places, like, there is this kind of culture of misogyny of, like, what a man should be. And, you know, like, I like to kind of compare him to Harry Styles in the sense, right? Like, Harry Styles is always kind of, like, paraded around. It's like, oh, like, he's fighting gender roles, right? And, like, I feel with Bad Bunny, you know, like, there's kind of the same narrative around him, you know, photographed in a skirt, wearing this, like, iconic Burberry dress to the Met Gala. Mm-hmm. His song, Yo Pareo Sola, he's, like, dressed up as a woman with, like, prosthetics and everything. It's pretty incredible. Think, like, the reason why he's appealing is that, you know, there for so long, there's kind of been this idea of, like, how a reggaeton artist should be, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's really fascinating to see someone play with gender, you know, who, like, acknowledge some of the other problems on the island, such as, like, the high rates of femicides and the deaths of transgender people on the island as well. And then, like, just in terms of his style, you know, I don't even know how to say this. It's just, like, it's really exciting to see. And it's also just, like, I hate to use this term, but, like, the female gaze. Like, if you see him and you're like, oh, okay, the curls, you got the nail polish, you got, like, the little sunglasses on, okay, like, let's go to the beach, you know? I think that's kind of the reason why he's appealing. It's the vibe from his music and his style really kind of gel together.
Yeah.
I think that one of the things that, you know, I've observed, you know, since the earlier parts of his career, I'm thinking right around, you know, I Like It Like That, and right after that, Breaks. And I remember talking to my students, and they were just, a lot of my queer students were captivated by Bad Bunny. And I think that is an engagement and a relationship with queer and trans audiences that has been sustained. It's like this ongoing conversation and part of Bad Bunny's persona, but it's not like this performance that's very forced or fake. It's sort of like this natural performance and conversation. And I think it has really opened up doors to alternative ways of performing and understanding masculinity in reggaeton.
Mm-hmm. And is reggaeton highly masculine in general, like macho?
That's a question. That's a great question. Did you want to answer that? I'm not being really bad.
Oh my God. Yeah. Really good question. Yeah. I would say definitely, like, reggaeton, when it was, like, first starting out, was, like, underground music. Like, there was a lot of criminalization around it, right? In Puerto Rico especially. And then you have, you know, artists like Daddy Yankee with Gasolina doing a really great crossover. Lyrically, like, these songs are kind of, it's very much like male perspective of sex and relationships and obsession. I mean, there's Luis Fonsi and Daddy Yankee's Despacito, right? Like, people don't think of women when they think of reggaeton, but, like, I think that's also changing. Like, Bad Bunny at his concert in PR, he brought out, you know, trans artist Villano Antillano. Mm-hmm. She's doing incredible work. And then he also brought out Young Miko. If you haven't listened to Puerto Rican Mommy, you definitely should. but yeah, I would definitely say it's a very male-dominated industry.
So that makes him even more transgressive and radical.
I don't know if radical is the right word, but, like, I definitely think, like, maybe, like, trailblazing.
Yeah.
I think he's radical for some listening constituencies, not all of them, right? For, I think for a lot of young people, some of his ideas around gender and sexuality aren't on the fringe. They're very much in line with how they view themselves in the world. Mm-hmm. And I think that's part of what feeds his popularity.
Well, I want to thank you both so much for coming on the show. I've learned a ton, and I have a new appreciation for Bad Bunny now. So thank you.
Absolutely.
Oh my God, yeah. Thank you. This was so much fun.
Thank you so much.
Oh, it's my pleasure. That's Maria Elena Cepeda, professor of Latino and Latina Studies at Williams College, and Izzy Ramirez, editor at Vox, where she recently wrote about Bad Bunny, who is performing this Friday and Saturday at SoFi Stadium. And that'll do it for us today on Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand, and I will see you tomorrow. El pecado y equivocarse es bonito. Los errores son placeres, igual que todos tus pasitos y solo mi.